We're looking at Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. You can see what the theme is almost at a glance. Have a look. Verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. Salt and light. We had a birthday in our household this last week. What we do with birthdays is Liz makes a cake and then she puts candles on it. And then we light the candles on the cake and then we summon in the victim, the person whose birthday it is. And as they walk in, the lights are out, on go, have the candles already lit, and then we start to sing in Swedish. That's because my wife is half Swedish. Her mum is Swedish. And so we sing, Jarmohon leva, Jarmohon leva, Jarmohon leva uti hundra daho, which means basically, may you live to 100 years. And it's part of the thing, of course, you know about birthday cakes, the little rituals. If in your culture you have birthday cakes, you then say to the person, now see if you can blow it all out with one breath. Or you sometimes say to people, little children, let's see if you can, how many candles you can light with one match. And I've done that, of course. I see if I can light all the candles on the cake with one match. And I'm thinking really of that as a sort of metaphor. When I see this thought about, let your light so shine, you are the light of the world. How many lights, how many lives could we light up with our one light? That's the challenge of a lifetime. We're not here for ourselves. We're not here in this world just to suck everything out of the world that we can. We're not here to be consumers. We're here to be contributors. It's one or the other. Consumer or contributor. It's one or the other. And here Jesus is saying to his friends, you're the light of the world. Your influence is to extend right through all of humanity. At first, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount, he's preaching to the crowds who are gathered around him. And he's painting a picture of the ideal Christian. This is how a Christian lives. This is the quality of life that we're looking for. But now as he comes to apply it, I sense that he's now speaking to those who are closely around him, those who are saying, we're taking discipleship seriously. And he's saying, you lot, you lot, you're the light of the world. You're the salt of the earth. You're expected to make a difference. You're expected to be a contributor. Here is Jesus speaking. And the significance of these wonderful words can hardly be exaggerated. Here were a bunch of rustic Galileans. That's all they were. John, probably the apostle, with his brother James, they probably still had the fish scales clinging to them after the night's fishing. There was Matthew just by them, who was going to write up the whole of the gospel. Just left his tax collecting work and say, okay, I'll follow Jesus. They knew nothing. They were nothing either in the Roman Empire. And yet they were expected to touch the world. They were, and we are. We are too. We're expected to touch the world by our life, our light, our prayers, our love, our service, our witness. The world is there in front of us. It's waiting. So the first word that comes to me as I look at this little passage is the word prominence. You're the salt of the earth. It's expected to make a difference. It's expected to be applied. You're the light of the world, verse 14. A city on a hill can't be hidden. So the expectation is that the light that represents Jesus Christ and those who follow him is to be prominently displayed. It's meant to banish the darkness. Prominence, prominence. I am the light of the world, Jesus had said in John chapter 8, verse 12. That is a universal claim. It's a unique claim. I am the light, not one of many lights, not a light, the light, the original light, underived, unborrowed, from which all other lights may borrow, but he's the original, the definitive light. And the text here, really, in front of us, implies that the salt is for the whole of the human race. Every race, every culture in sight, the salt that represents Christ's influence is meant for them. Same with the light of the whole world. That's what it's for. It's universal, right through every culture, from Greenland right down to South America, from Japan right through to America. The fact is that what is happening, ladies and gentlemen, what is happening to the Christian church down the ages is more important for the world than what is happening to any other group. We may say, oh, we're not much. Jesus says you're the light of the world. I say it again, what is happening to the Christian church is more important for the world than what is happening to any other group. Somebody once said, a life hid with Christ cannot be hid from others. So there implied is the unconscious power of goodness. When there's goodness in somebody's life or in a culture, in a society, it's usually unconscious. They don't know that they're displaying goodness. Others ought to notice, however. It's very attractive when you come up against real goodness for the first time. I'm not talking about fictional goodness. I'm talking about real goodness, not the goodness of the storybooks. Because as Simone Weil, a Jewish theologian, once said, she made this very point, nothing, she said, is so beautiful and wonderful. Nothing is so full of sweet and perpetual ecstasy as the good. Then she went on, no desert is so dreary, monotonous, and boring as evil. But, she said, with fantasy, it is the other way round. Fictional good is boring and flat, while fictional evil is varied and intriguing, attractive, profound, and full of charm. Well, I agree with that. Stories, fictional stories of very good people make a bad buy on the whole. Little Lord Fauntleroy, all that sort of thing, I find to be nauseatingly boring. While the late Agatha Christie or Frederick Forsyth or whichever author you care to nominate have fascinated millions of their readers with the stories of murder and political violence and intrigue. Fascinating. But real life turns the tables completely. Real life brings you to Kosovo, to the southern Sudan, or to those parts when I remember visiting Romania shortly after the Ceausescu revolution, see one or two of those cities that had been just ironed out flat and grey, without any sort of distinctiveness, without any sort of character. That's the result of evil. Boring, flat, monotonous, a desert. But real goodness. Have you met real goodness in somebody's life? Somebody who's really good? When they come to visit you in your flat, you don't want them to go. You say to them, oh, please stay. Let's have another cup of coffee. You don't want them to go. That's because real goodness is extremely attractive and is more powerful than the evil. So that's my first word, prominence. The light is supposed to be displayed, visible, so that others can benefit, so that the darkness will be affected. The salt is meant to be applied and there, so that the rottenness will be dealt with. That's my first word, prominence. The second word, I think, in association with this passage, is the word difference. Oh, salt and light, they're meant to make a difference. If they don't make a difference, then they're not salt and they're not light. Salt, its value lies in the fact that it's different from the substance to which it's applied. So those fishermen listening to Jesus' words would have understood this. They'd have brought in their night's catch from the Sea of Galilee. The tilapia fish would have been set out there by the side that they'd caught there You can still catch it today. Tilapia fish is the fish. They'd have had it packed, ready for transport to the Jerusalem fish markets. But of course, first it would be packed in salt to preserve it against corruption. So they would have understood this terminology. But we do as well. The value of the Christian witness in our world lies in the fact that Christianity has in it an amazing power, if it's there, if it's real. Salt, what is it there for? Why, it's to halt corruption, is to improve the flavor of society, and is to create thirst for the better things. What about the light? It's there to dispel the darkness, is to attract the seeker, and is to enlighten the believer. You can see this in many lives. Doesn't take much. Few words spoken, a little touch of goodness, and somebody's life can be turned right round. I take as one of my illustrations, some here will remember the visit of the preacher Stephen Lungu from Malawi to this pulpit. Stephen Lungu began as a boy on the streets, abandoned by his mother, never went to school, couldn't read or write, became a gang leader in Zimbabwe. And at the very meeting, he decided to go with his gang to blow up with explosives. He was converted at the meeting. How did it happen? One person stood up in that meeting with 5 minutes to go before detonation. All the entrances of the gathering were blocked by the gang members, ready with their petrol bombs and everything else. With 5 minutes to go, this girl stood up in the meeting and gave her Christian witness and spoke about her faith in Christ. And Stephen Lungu said to me afterwards, I found myself riveted by this girl. He wrote it all up in his book later, Freedom Fighter. That started it. He went to the front of the meeting, met the preacher, tears pouring down his face, handed in his guns, his explosives, his weapons at the preacher's feet, and said, I want to know, who is this Jesus about whom you've been speaking? Another gang had meanwhile come along to blow up the same meeting, and they did attack. 100 people died that night, and with explosions going on all around, Stephen Lungu was making his peace with Jesus Christ at the feet of the preacher. Next day, he was on the buses, witnessing in Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe. And as he put it to me later, he said, I was still sleeping under bridges. I was still eating out of dustbins. But he said, Christ had his hold upon me from that moment. He said, I had no fellowship. I didn't know what Christians were. I didn't know who were the Christians. All I knew was that Jesus had come into my life. And I wanted to tell everybody in sight. So that very first day on the buses, I began to tell the whole busload, something happened to me, ladies and gentlemen, last night. Let me tell you about it. As they got off the first stop, some people said, tell us more. By that stage, they were out of the bus. He said, get down in the dust. Get down in the road on your knees. And all he could think of was to say, Jesus, these people want to know you. Here they are. And they joined the church. It doesn't take much. One person, and a life can be turned around. Stephen now can preach in 7 languages, including Dutch. But it started with a turnaround, one moment, one person. Light is stronger than darkness. It must be. It always is. The difference it makes is staggering. So those are 2 things that we ought to think about. Prominence, it's got to be displayed, and then the difference that is expected when the salt of the earth is applied, when the light of the world is shining in a community or through an individual. It's not to be tucked away in a drawer. And either we are helping to purify and preserve society like salt, or the corruption of society will rot us. It's kill or cure. If we're not actively engaging and changing the world by our own transformed life, then it can be guaranteed that the world will get you Either your light is actually shining, or the darkness will sweep in and engulf you. But I want to say to anybody here who's just come into London, the advantage is with you in your place of witness or work or study. If you're a student in some hall of residence, the advantage is with you. You don't have to feel too self-protective. You can go in and believe that your influence will have an effect as a Christian. Those porno pictures plastered up in various places will disappear if you maintain your witness. The language will change. The standards will be jacked up. Only takes one person. Such is the power of Christ in a person's life, the light of the world. You are the light of the world, he says. So, prominence and difference. Those are two important words. Here's the third little word I associate with this passage. And it is the word influence. Influence. Because as we read the passage and as we see what Christ says to his friends, that you are the light of the world, you are the salt of the earth, you're to let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. The expectation is that the influence will permeate society and the family and the street and the block of flats. It will. It's light for everybody, light for the world. And our lives then, are, in some strange way, are supposed to be a judgment on society. When you shine a light into a dark room, a dusty room, it shows up all the cobwebs, the little spiders start scurrying about, the cockroaches scamper for cover. It's because the light has come as a sort of judgment. They're afraid. That is what the effect of a Christian witness should be. It should act as a kind of judgment upon society to show that life without Christ is tasteless, and is to show that life without Christ is decaying. It only takes one person. Take the world of music and the arts. I know a man called Garth Hewitt who's made a number of albums. We met him in this church. Garth Hewitt travels around as a sort of singing troubadour. And a reporter once said to him, when you're in concert and there's a group of people who don't really believe in front of you, what do you see your role as being? And Garth said, I'm there to create doubt. I'm there to create doubt in the minds of the ardent unbelievers. I'm there to undermine their worldview. I'm there to say, are you sure that you're just a collection of biochemical reactions? Are you quite sure that you're only just part of an impersonal, mechanistic universe? Are you sure? And by my lyrics, by my words, by my approach, I am undermining them all the time, creating doubt. That's one way of doing it. The influence, it only takes one. And the advantage is with that one. Always, the light is stronger than the darkness. We must believe that. When the words of Christ and the principles of Christ take hold upon a nation or a society or an individual, we can expect the life of that society or individual to be improved and enhanced. You've only got to look around the world to see examples of that happening. Happens again and again. Of course, we recognize that there's still plenty wrong with the world. Critics will sometimes say, how can Christianity be any good after 2,000 years? And I think I would reply to them, you might as well argue, soap must be a very ineffective cleansing agent. Why isn't it cleansing away the dirt all around quicker? Well, soap is effective if it's used and applied. And Christ's influence is as powerful as ever to change. And it's basically a moral power, not a sensational power. So our calling is to maintain contact with the world, to maintain our sharpness, to let the light of Christ shine in our own lives and shine out of into our surroundings and our environment. It's Oz Guinness, who's an intellectual from this country, now residing and lecturing in the United States, who once said, "The power of the Christian life should never be quarantined within the church congregation." Of course, we need to get together, as we do. Of course, we need to support each other, take part in training groups, get our act together, get our resources into place. But then we go out and we allow that influence to make itself felt in our world. That's why we love to have open-air preaching. So our open-air preachers will be going out this afternoon, Speaker's Corner, various other places during the course of the week, just to let that banner be flown high for Christ, to let the light shine, and for people to understand there is another way. There is another way, and we're representatives of that better way. It only takes one. And sometimes it's just the influence that's going on in a congregation or in a society, in a fellowship. No words even need to be spoken. I think of a girl student. She was a music student who applied to come to a thing that was being run by Michael Bourne, the previous rector of this church, and myself. It was a national week. We called it grandly the Music, Drama and Radio Workshop. And we put it on in Bristol one summer. And people were invited from all over the country, young people, to come and share and get that expertise together. And this young woman, her name was Anne Alford. I remember her well. She said, "I would like to come, but I'm not a Christian at all. Not one little bit. Do you mind?" I said, "All right, is there a place for me?" So he said to her, "There's one place left. You can have it. As long as you don't mind that this is a Christian outfit. We're going to have prayers, things like that. Can you cope with that?" She said, "I can cope with that." So she came. And we had a great week. And at the end of the week, we put on a great concert for the city of Bristol to display the things we'd learned. She was part of that, all of that. And at the end of the show, a couple of people who had perhaps been rather on the edge of the fellowship said to Anne Alford, because they could twig that she wasn't really much in the life of the church, they said to her, "Come on, Anne, let's go off. We'll slope off to the Mecca ballroom." So they went off and leaving us to clear up. And standing there in the Mecca ballroom, she became a Christian. Later when we heard about it, we said to Anne, but why? Just like that? And in the Mecca ballroom? Oh, she said, it was the transition of atmosphere from coming out of the fellowship and the drive and the purpose of the music workshop, and then to go into what I felt was the plastic sham atmosphere of the Mecca ballroom. She said, standing there, I realized I was choosing between two worlds. And she said, then and there, I chose. No one had said a word to her in the music workshop about, you must change your ways, or, you know, Jesus Christ is better. No one had done any of that. It was just the realization of the influence of Christ in one place and in that community made her change her mind then and there. She joined All Souls Church later on as a member. Three words: prominence. It's got to be displayed. Difference. It's got to make a difference. And influence. That influence is expected in a community, on a block of flats, or wherever. And last of all, evidence. That's my last word. Salt. You see, salt, unless it retains its saltness, it's no good. There's got to be evidence that it is good and it is at work. Unsalted Christians are similarly really only fit for the compost heap. That's the assumption of this passage. Salt without salt? Lights that don't shine? That's an impossibility. So it's the Apostle Paul who talks in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 5 of this kind of Christian. He writes, "They will hold to the outward form of our religion, but reject its real power." And lest anybody here feels a little bit guilty and says, "Look, I can't be a Stephen Lungu. I can't go out and be a terrific witness in society. How could I?" Let me comfort us all with the words of Guy King, who was a rector in Beckenham, Kent, some years ago. He said in his little commentary, "Don't worry too greatly. if you find you can't say much or do much, your business is especially to be much. That is the nature of the salt, he says. So are we determined that our so short stay on planet Earth, and perhaps our reasonably short stay in London, is going to be as effective as possible, using our one light, maybe to light other lights, our sense of calling? So these words, you are the light of the world, you're the salt of the earth, that has the ideas of prominence, it's got to be set forth. A difference is expected in our lives. The influence penetrating halls of residence, business houses, families, neighbors, and then the evidence. It is to be there. If the light is in our lives, it will be evidenced. If the salt is there, it's going to be used to deal with rottenness and corruption. It was Henry Holland, who was one of our great eye surgeon missionaries in India, who once said, if we Christians don't outlive and outlove, we don't deserve to win. And ultimately, it is the degree to which we let Christ rule and shape our lives which will determine whether we can reflect to the world what it is really thirsting for, a new way of living and a new kind of loving. Let's pray. Go forth in his name, proclaiming Jesus reigns. Now is the time for the church to arise and proclaim him, Jesus, Savior, Redeemer, and Lord. Strengthen then, O Lord, that light in our lives. Strengthen our resolve that we will be used to make a difference here in this dark world. And help us to see that with you in our lives, the advantage lies with us, for your holy name's sake. Amen.